From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. On our interfaith calendar, August 30th marks the start of the 8-day Jain festival of Parashana Parva, signifying human emergence into a new world of spiritual and moral refinement. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
If you are among those who know that marriage between a man and a woman is not the same as the union of two persons of the same sex, choose life, choose freedom. World Congress of Families is assembling the best pro-family leaders, experts, and activists from the five continents in Madrid.
Gather in Sydney, Australia for the 7th World Congress of Families.
The World Congress of Families 5 will be held in Amsterdam. The 4th World Congress of Families was held last year in Warsaw, Poland, with previous conferences in Mexico City in 2004, in Geneva in 1999, and Prague in 1997.
Whether they're busy giving their stamp of approval for Vladimir Putin's extreme anti-gay legislation in Russia, or encouraging bigoted policies elsewhere around the globe, the Radical World Congress of Families has had significant success in promoting discrimination against LGBT persons and women worldwide. With the endorsement of powerful culture war groups like the Family Research Council, Focus on the Family, and Alliance Defending Freedom, their insidious work has remained largely under the mainstream radar until now. A comprehensive new report from the Human Rights Campaign connects the dots and exposes the harm that World Congress of Families is engaged in. And on this week's show, right here on State of Belief Radio, you'll meet the report's author, Rebecca Parks.
Faith is not organized religion. It is a personal relationship with Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior.
We're supposed to have freedom of religion, not freedom from religion.
A one-way wall where the state would not dictate to the church, but the church would certainly play a role in the state.
I think it's fair to say that the state of Texas has been more than generous in contributing to the conflation of religion and politics in this country. This week, journalist Sarah Posner wrote in The American Prospect about Joyce Elaine White, who traveled a long and complicated journey through dominionist political fundamentalism in Texas and beyond, before embarking on the painful process of leaving the religious right. It is a compelling story, and Elaine White will be with us today on State of Belief Radio. But first,
religion ought to affirm what we are doing, not be an escapism from what is done. And some of us are so heavenly bound that we're no earthly good.
It's now been 3 weeks since the police shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. A funeral service was held this past Monday, but both the local fallout and the national conversation have continued. As part of that conversation, we've been working to bring together two leading voices from the intersection of faith and social justice. And I'm very pleased to be able to do that today. The very Reverend Dr. Gary Hall is Dean of the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Not shying away from controversy, Gary's tenure has been marked by an uncompromising commitment to faith-informed leadership. The Reverend Dr. Derek Harkins is Senior Pastor at the 19th Street Baptist Church in Washington. A prominent leader and speaker on the national stage, Derek has contributed generously to the public discourse on justice and inclusivity for decades. And so today, we gather by phone. Derek, Gary, I'm very grateful to be joined by both of you on State of Belief Radio. The tragedy in Ferguson has raised the question for many faith leaders nationwide, what is my role in all of this, and more broadly, what is my role in issues of race today? Reverend Hall, would you begin, when you looked at this thing in Ferguson, how long did it take you to figure out what you needed to be doing and what did you focus on first?
It didn't take me long this time, but that's partially because I really was slow on the uptake a year ago with the George Zimmerman verdict, and I didn't realize how my lack of response to the verdict in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin really was seen as a lack of concern.
Uh-huh.
And so I learned from that this year that the Michael Brown shooting and the incredibly just bad response of the authorities in Ferguson really needed a quick response from the cathedral and from me. And that was twofold. One of them was the Michael Brown shooting, as the facts came out in terms of the number of shots fired and the length of time he lay there, and then the incredible way in which the police department tried to stigmatize the victim in that shooting just became more and more outrageous and just needed some response. That was one thing. The other thing was that we heard fairly soon from the Attorney General's office that Eric Holder came back with real concern expressed to him by the clergy leaders in Ferguson. Where was the white church in this?
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt that I needed to speak not only because of my own sense, but also that I needed to speak in a way that would call white clergy into some kind of response as well.
Derek, I identify so much with what Gary said as a pastor in a primarily white congregation and concerns about what white clergy were doing. I am more conscious than ever that you are not only pastor in a black congregation and you have to speak as a pastor, but I realize that you're in a situation I've never had to experience, and that is you're thinking that could be my son. And
absolutely. You make an incredibly important point, because even before talking about systemic versus incidental, which I think is very much a part of this, it's at the crux of this conversation, I think that there's a level of weariness in spirit that so many in the African-American community, and I think even more broadly, but certainly in the African-American community, have felt. And I think one of the things about Ferguson that, along with the injustice of what it appears happened to Michael Brown, you've got to remember that literally about a year ago, we were lamenting at a verdict that I think, you know, summarily was seen as unjust and just a disparagement to the memory of Trayvon Martin. You got to remember that just several weeks ago, we watched a man in Staten Island, you know, who literally was being, quote, apprehended for potentially selling, you know, bootleg cigarettes, being choked to death. And the fact that those are just the ones that obviously kind of captured the moment, along with the countless numbers of other incidents like this, it weighs on one's spirit. And as a pastor, I find that kind of the first place that I've got to go is to try to deal with a measure of hurt and a sense of, again, just spiritual weariness that I think is part of this conversation. I think that's evidenced itself in a lot of different ways. I think some of the frustration that we've witnessed in Ferguson is certainly born out of that. People forget that, you know, this conversation has not, there's been no occasion for it to stop. I mean, from the point of where we were last year with the Zimmerman verdict, as Dean Hall spoke about, this conversation has in large measure been ongoing. And because even if there's been a moment or a respite of a moment, invariably there's been another occasion where our hearts are yet broken again. And you're so right about the fact. And it's particularly hurtful when there's this concerted effort, whether it's by the right-wing media, whether it's by, you know, just all kinds of forces to try to vilify the victim, which I think then, you know, maybe they don't realize it, but it almost in a sense it mitigates the idea, well, maybe this was, you know, just dessert for something as, again, as innocuous, even if it was proven to be, you know, that he had grabbed a handful of cigarettes or whatever it might have been. I mean, there's nothing that in any way, shape, or form could validate what happened to Michael Brown. And I think that that's the hurt, but also the vulnerability. You're so right. I mean, I just dare say that so many people do not understand that to equip a young African-American male for existence and survival in 20th century America, be it urban, suburban, or even for that matter, rural, there's got to be a component of understanding that this kind of reality can visit itself upon them at any given point, because we see it over and over again. And let me just real quickly say, I think that the other thing about this moment is that it helps us to see, based on what we've seen by way of the response of the police department there, the further discussion around the militarization of police departments across the country, that this is a systemic issue, as is racism, and it is not solely incidental. We can't point to an isolated incident in Ferguson. We're really talking about a much larger, very difficult, very painful, but essential conversation.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you all, when you bring up this subject, as I know you do, as I do myself, do you find people of faith ready to talk about this matter as a matter of spirituality, or do they tend to come at it with just a broader view than that?
This is Gary. I'd say it's mixed. I think that for many people, at least at the cathedral, this is a kind of social issue that needs attention. I think, though, for I'm trying to raise the issue that this is an issue of theological importance. Yeah. I mean, last Sunday when I preached about Michael Brown and the Ferguson thing, our readings were the Exodus reading of the two Egyptian midwives saving the baby Moses. That reading begins by saying, Pharaoh clamped down on the Israelites because he did not know Joseph and he feared the Israelites. And you see this kind of cross-cultural fear and hatred all the way through the scriptures. And in some ways, one of the deep arguments in the scriptures is God's call to us to transcend our fear of each other and our tendency to think that we're normative and the people that are different from us are, there's something wrong with them, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that runs all the way through the scriptures, both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I think increasingly I'm coming to see that the work we need to do about systemic racism and injustice is deeply the work of the prophets and Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is a growing sense in the church that this is a theological as well as just a social issue.
Derek, it makes me want to tweak the question just a little bit, because I'm curious, in your setting, is your message to your congregation about this the same as your message to the communities in which you function and to the forums to which you speak?
I think Gary hits it well on the head that there's a theological underpinning here, but at the same time, I would say to somebody to be careful not to spiritualize an issue that has a very concrete reality, meaning that I think that the transcendent presence of faith in this is critical, essential. We've seen that over and over again. It sustains us. It compels us. It helps us to move toward what we've got to move toward ultimately around this issue in terms of justice and in terms of the conversation around race. But at the same time, I believe in a tactile faith. I believe in a faith that engages the world. I love one of my favorite hymns Charles Wesley wrote back in the 1700s, you know, a charge to keep I have, a God to glorify, to serve this present age. And I think that if we can understand that our faith calls us to the hard questions, it doesn't call us to be able to retreat from this, I think that that's critical. And it means that we have that place to have these difficult conversations, even in a faith, community of faith. So I make it a point, as I talk about these things, certainly as I preach to my own congregation and elsewhere, but yes, that we have a transcendent reality that we know and understand to be God, and that transcendent reality has sustained us. However, we are placed in the reality of a present context, and we've got to bring to bear our faith and our spiritual depths to that concern and not just see things in sort of a gauzy sense of, well, God will take care of this in the end. And that's maybe an oversimplification, but I think it speaks to the realities of the kinds of conversations we're going to have. I think that what happened in Ferguson, for all of its onerous and odious complexity, I think we're going to sadly see that even more and more as light is shed begrudgingly upon the Ferguson police, but I think nevertheless shed. I think we're going to see that there's some harsh realities that are there that are emblematic of what is the case across the country. You're going to have some people who react by saying, well, no, that's not the case, because obviously they don't want to wrestle with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people of faith are going to need to understand that even if it's painful to sort of disclose that, it's our faith that gives us the ability to do that. So I'm hoping that we understand this has got to be a systemic conversation and not an incidental one, because sadly there'll be other incidents that arise. But this conversation has to be one that really cuts to the quick.
My guest for a terribly important conversation about what the past 3 weeks in Ferguson and beyond have taught us about the tenuous relationship between race, faith, power in this country are the very Reverend Gary Hall, Dean of the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., and the Reverend Dr. Derek Harkins, Senior Pastor at the 19th Street Baptist Church, also in Washington. I think I became so sensitive, even more so than before. There's only one time, I guess, that I've seen the distinction in sensitivity when we were dealing with Katrina. I saw there the pain that happens in the black community that's not always happening in the white community. How do you deal with that yourself in speaking to the cathedral congregation?
One of the problems of white privilege is that you come to think that you're normative. The cathedral, as wonderful and beautiful as it is also in the most affluent and whitest part of the District of Columbia. Even though the district is majority African American, I live and work in the part of the district that is really overwhelmingly white. And
mm-hmm.
One of the things I've learned over the course of my life is that affluence and privilege really isolates you in a way. And so, and talking to my African American colleagues, some of them on the staff here, who assist me on Sundays, is that this issue is not optional for people of color. African Americans have to engage this issue every day. It is very close to them, and my privilege isolates me from having to deal with this on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the issues I've had to confront personally before I've really had to sort of bring it to the attention of the faith community is that this can't be optional for me. I need to do my own work, coming to understand my own social, racial, cultural location and how kind of contingent and specific that is. And secondly, then, I need to get to know people of color. It's not just that I need to sort of understand the issues. I need to really do the work to locate myself on the issues, and then I need to reach out and make and build relationships. And so I came to that understanding personally in the last year between the George Zimmerman verdict and this event.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've really been doing this work in the last year to kind of actually kind of live that out a bit. And so when this thing happened, I was much more open to the pain and importance of addressing the pain than I was a year ago. So I think we white folks have to just do our work, and we've got to reach out and build relationships with people of color.
Derek, I'm really eager to know, what is your message for white clergy and white people who don't understand this?
I would say that there's a level of hurt, there's a level of reality for this that may not be discernible outside of the experience of what it means to be African-American in America in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that if an Eric Holder can talk about what it means to be looked upon with suspicion by the police, as he talked about having had that occurrence, just as readily as we can see what happened to Michael Brown, I think it needs to be clear to people that this is not an over-amplification of an issue. It's very real and it's very heartfelt. And it's incredibly, it's just an incredibly painful reality. And I would want people to understand that and realize that it gets borne out in frustration, as we've seen in some instances in Ferguson. But it also gets borne out just in an incredible internalized sadness and heaviness as well.
Gary, I have one more question. It seems to me that people in our positions have to be sensitive both to the pastoral needs that require comfort and assurance, but also then to the social justice needs of demand and change that has to take place. How do you balance that?
I remember Bill Coffin, who was my mentor in my early days, my hero, essentially said that the prophetic work is ultimately pastoral.
Mm-hmm.
and that there is a false dichotomy between preaching the gospel and caring for people, both personally, pastorally, and caring for their souls. One of my favorite little anecdotes is that there was a period in when I was working at All Saints Pasadena, I squired Kenneth Leach, who is the great Church of England priest who writes about prayer, who is also very much involved in social justice issues in East London. And he was in this country giving a talk about the social justice work he was doing. And a woman came up to him after the talk and said, "I'm really amazed at the coincidence. Has anyone ever talked to you about it?" And he said, "What coincidence?" And the woman said, "You gave a very impassioned talk about social justice, but do you know there's the man with exactly your name who writes about prayer?" And he said, "That's me." And this woman, like, was just totally shocked that a person who wrote about prayer could also care about justice. And I think part of our job as pastors is to show people that loving God and following Jesus have multiple dimensions to them, and that telling them the truth is actually caring for them. You know? And to me, the way in, empathetically, for me, that I've engaged the Michael Brown story is to ask people to identify with his family and with him and with those who love him, and just to think about the loss of that young life and what that feels like to his family and to his community. And I think people can enter that issue there. And then, of course, we've got to sort of lead them into thinking, as Derek just said, about the systemic and justice issues involved. But I want to always hold on to a kind of seamless garment of the prophetic and the pastoral, because I think otherwise, if we're just being prophetic without being pastoral, we're just sort of beating people up. And I don't want to do that. But I think we want to be prophetic precisely out of our care for them.
I've been speaking with the very Reverend Gary Hall, Dean of the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., and an outspoken proponent of uncompromising action for justice and equality, and the Reverend Derek Harkin, Senior Pastor of the 19th Street Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., and a longtime leader in the struggle for social justice and civil rights. Derek and Gary, I wanted the two of you specifically because actually your last answer, Gary, was the reason why. You do bring together the pastoral and the prophetic, and it's time that we not just bump along from crisis to crisis in this thing about race, but to stay with it until we get some justice, more than we see now, and maybe even to a solution that would let us celebrate what's happened. Thanks again for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
You're very welcome, and thank you so much for having me, Walton.
The report's cover page is titled, in bold red and blue text, "Exposed, the World Congress of Families, an American organization exporting hate." The report, released this week by our friends at the Human Rights Campaign, lays out in stark terms the many ways this organization, the World Congress of Families, has successfully spread hate around the world and made life worse for LGBT people all around the globe. Joining me right now is the report's author, Rebecca Parks. Rebecca, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
What is the World Congress of Families, and where did they come from?
Well, the World Congress of Families frames themselves as sort of an umbrella group for international, they call themselves pro-family activists. We call them anti-LGBT and anti-women's rights activists. They've been around since about 1997, and they're based in Illinois, and their entire board and all of their staff are Americans, although they, again, fancy themselves as an international group. And what they do is every couple years they host large gatherings of people from all over the world to sort of strategize the next moves of the anti-LGBT movement around the world.
I try my best to keep on top of organizations that we need to be watching, and honestly, I didn't know anything about World Congress of Families. Should I have known that?
No, I mean, they like to keep a fairly low profile here in the United States. They're pretty well known around the world. They've hosted I think, 6 or 7 of these major international conferences, but they've never had one in the United States, so it's not something that folks here at home are real familiar with.
I see. How do they do their work?
Well, they have connections with quite a few lawmakers and high-level policymakers in countries around the world, particularly in Russia and Eastern Europe. And they're able to go overseas and have meetings with these influential leaders and make suggestions to them about potential legislation they could pursue, such as the ban on LGBT propaganda that we saw pass in Russia last year.
Mm-hmm. They obviously associate with a lot of other groups and get endorsements from them. Tell us about some of the groups that think they're really good.
The World Congress of Families itself has a very small budget, and they have to rely on support from some of their partner organizations. And while you may not have heard of the World Congress itself, you've definitely heard of some of their partner organizations, which has included Focus on the Family, the American Family Association, the Alliance Defending Freedom, these major, major American extremist anti-LGBT groups.
So are they effective in their hate propaganda?
Yeah, we think that they have been effective, predominantly in Russia and Eastern Europe, where they've been working for a very long time. They collaborated with the author of that propaganda ban that passed in Russia last year, and they were very proud of the work that they've done. Their managing director called Vladimir Putin Christian savior to the world for passing these anti-LGBT and anti-women's rights laws.
Mm. Do they see themselves as a religion-based organization, or is it a political-based organization, or do they see themselves as both?
I would say both. They claim to represent a cross-section of faiths and religious groups, but they have been most strongly associated with conservative Catholic groups, conservative groups associated with the Mormon Church, and as well as some evangelical Protestant organizations, although they would say themselves that they are not a faith group, that they are an advocacy and a pro-family organization.
Mm-hmm. How are they most effective?
These are, you know, they're fairly marginal people here at home who don't have access to some of the halls of power in Washington or in their state capitals, but they're able to go overseas and just have these meetings with incredibly powerful people. You know, I mentioned the folks they met with in Russia, and then also in Africa, they've had longtime connections with the wife of the president of Uganda and the wife of the president of Nigeria, both countries where we have seen terrible anti-LGBT laws passed in the last year.
Mm-hmm. Why are they focusing on Russia now, and why have they been so welcomed there at a time when so many other Western influences are viewed with suspicion?
I think it's sort of a confluence of factors has resulted in the World Congress of Families being so influential in Russia. I think Vladimir Putin has really seen, as some of his popularity has waned in Russia, he's really turned to this sort of social policy and scapegoating of LGBT folks and other minorities as a means to shore up his support. And the mm-hmm. World Congress of Families has been helping him with that. And he's really trying to embrace the Orthodox Church and these sort of extreme conservative forces in his own country. And so it was an opportunity for groups like the World Congress of Families to come in and provide assistance with that. You know, they've had to themselves almost back away a little bit from Putin after the annexation of Crimea earlier mm-hmm. this year. They were planning to hold an event in Moscow this fall that they had to cancel because of all the sanctions that had been imposed by the United States and the EU on Russia. So they've had to backpedal from Putin a bit, although, of course, they still embrace his policies.
So the fact that they have probably contributed to his hold on power, they look at Putin as just another person to help them get what they want done on the ground. Is that right?
That's right. They've really embraced his sort of spiritual and moral outlook on Russia, and they see him as a kindred spirit.
Yeah. My sense is that there are a lot of people who, when you're talking about Russia, they still have a carryover of some old images related to communism and Stalinism and all of that.
We've actually seen the polling numbers in Russia moving in the wrong direction. Same-sex sexual activity was first decriminalized in Russia in the 90s. And throughout the 90s and the early 2000s, we saw growing acceptance of LGBT folks in Russia. Uh-huh. But, you know, in the last 10 years or so, we've actually seen the numbers move in the opposite direction. And now 78% of Russians consider homosexuality to be a sickness or some sort of moral defect, and those numbers have moved aggressively in the last 10 years in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about their impact on Africa.
Sure. They've been holding events in Africa for at least the last 5 years. World Congress of Families has had several regional events in Nigeria, and Nigeria is really one of the hotbeds of anti-LGBT sentiment in Africa right now. Just earlier this year, they passed a law that could punish what they call aggravated homosexuality with up to life in prison. And the World Congress of Families and their representatives have been traveling to Africa and urging Nigeria and other nations to stand up to the sexual rights agenda of the West and really inflaming some of these tensions that we've seen explode in arrests and prosecutions and violence against LGBT people.
I want you to be as pointed as you want to be in what every listener should know that they can find in this report.
What you'll be able to find in this report is detailed information on where the World Congress of Families has been active around the world, where they're going to be in the next year, where some of their funding comes from, and what they've been telling leaders around the world about LGBT people.
When you, as with anything, look at the money trail, you find out a lot. What'd you find out about their mission and tactics when you looked at the money trail?
Well, they're organized as a 501c3 organization, so the amount that you can find publicly about the money trail is somewhat limited. But we've found that although the World Congress of Families itself has such a small annual budget, you know, of less than $500,000, their partner organizations that are helping support them have an annual combined budget of about $216 million. So there's a tremendous reservoir of funds available for this kind of work that they're tapping into.
You know, I'm just astounded because what that translates to in other language is that people are contributing a lot of money to hate.
Yeah, yep. I think that's correct. And a lot of times, I'm not even sure people know when they donate to some of these groups that have been partners of the World Congress of Families, what it is that that money could be going to.
Our listeners tend to be not just listeners, but activists. Are there actions that Americans can take to oppose this kind of destructive and really even deadly activism in the name of religion and morality?
Absolutely. We are going to see next year the World Congress of Families in October of 2015 is hosting their first ever summit in the United States in Salt Lake City. And I think that's a real opportunity for activists to let them know that they're not welcome to hold these kind of hate conferences on American soil or anywhere, really, but particularly here at home. And we've seen a lot of success that activists have had recently. The World Congress is planning an event in Australia, and we've seen Australian activists really take this report and other information about them and use it to shine a spotlight on who these folks are and let them know that they're not welcome to bring their message to Melbourne. We've seen groups like the World Congress of Families and other groups that are doing similar work really escalating their activity. I think a lot of people have the perception, and it's probably true, that we're winning the fight for LGBT equality here at home. You know, state after state after state is embracing marriage equality. And a lot of these people, as they're seeing victory slip away from them at home, are looking for opportunities overseas where they can go and have some more influence and have an effect. And so I think it's really important that people keep following these groups as they're traveling the world and spreading their anti-LGBT message.
Rebecca Parks is the author of a new report from the Human Rights Campaign titled Exposed, the World Congress of Families, an American organization exporting hate. That report is available free of charge at www.hrc.org. Rebecca, this is scary stuff. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
You have to read journalist Sarah Posner's recent piece in the American Prospect magazine. It's titled The Chains of Dominion. Sarah profiles a once prominent leader of the political religious right, Elaine White. Elaine was in the thick of this unholy alliance in a place where it thrives, Texas, USA. I used to live there. I should know. But she has made incredibly difficult decisions that have her now following her conscience and moving in a different direction. It's a powerful and intensely personal story, offering a rare view into a power structure that exerts immense influence over our national politics. That's why I am so very grateful to have her join us here on State of Belief Radio. Elaine, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You and I share a very specific history, having been deeply involved in conservative Christian ministry at a time when an overt takeover of Republican politics by religious dogmatists took place. It was not something that I could be a part of, and walking away from it was tremendously difficult and painful, but it was the thing to do. I know your story is remarkably similar. You were executive director of the Capital City Christian Coalition in Austin, Texas, and the Christian Coalition's lobbyist in the state capitol. What made you decide to change?
My life came crashing in on the dogma that I had grown up with. Mm-hmm. That is what made me change.
How significant were one-on-one relationships with family members and others who were being demonized by the Texas conservatives in moving you toward this decision to walk away from that work?
When I was involved in the Christian Coalition, we had two issues, basically. One was we were anti-abortion. Second, we were anti-homosexual. So, mm-hmm. You know, those were our two issues. And I remember going to the National Republican Convention in San Diego, and those were the only two issues that I knew about, but I was an alternate. I wasn't a delegate, but I was an alternate. I was part of the team there, and I really had no idea how to vote on anything else. But what happened to me was I had a close family member who had to have an abortion, mm-hmm. and her life depended on it, and I had to accompany her, and I had to rethink all my opposition to that. And then I had another close family member who came out as homosexual. And so when my life came face to face with what I had been propounding, mm-hmm. you know, I had mud in my face.
Mm-hmm.
I just had to rethink everything, and then I ended a marriage of 24 years, mm-hmm. and so, I mean, that's not something you do in conservative Christianity,
right.
So I pretty much took myself out of everything that I had been doing, and I ended up going to a church. The pastor of the church was someone that I had debated on public television, and he's a liberal Presbyterian pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And he met with me for a year and a half every Friday for breakfast and helped me deprogram.
That's an interesting way of putting that, because there really is, for people who don't understand it, there really is a deprogramming necessity about coming out of that kind of dominionist theology, isn't there?
Right. It's all about, you have to look at how you view the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at how you view the creeds. There's a lot that you have to look at, and it takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of pain to do that.
Right. Did you ever have the experience of maybe having a conversation with that pastor or someone else about what was changing, and you get alone and you begin to wonder, am I doing the right thing?
Oh, well, Dr. Gaddy, I would say that that is a 24/7 conversation I have with myself.
Yeah. And how are you doing with it?
I trust in a deity who is much greater than my little West Texas upbringing understanding.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think that Christians have the only answer to mm-hmm. being in touch with God. I mean, mm-hmm. I believe that there is one God, and he speaks in many voices,
yeah.
or she, mm-hmm. whatever.
Mm-hmm. Where was the strength to make public what you were feeling personally, privately?
I think that there is a huge transition that's going on in Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love the books by Karen Armstrong and Phyllis Tickle and Frank Schaeffer. I think that we are looking at this institution that we have constructed,
mm-hmm.
and now we're saying, well, would Jesus really want to be a member of this church?
Mm-hmm.
So I started thinking, I don't know if I can really continue in the institutional Christian vein, even though I was a missionary for 12 years. I started churches on college campuses. And I think that we somehow missed the message of what Jesus was saying.
Yeah. Elaine, how do you make that decision and not throw out the good with the bad?
Well, Dr. Gatti, all I am doing is, at this point in my life, I am trying to do what Jesus said, to love God and to love my neighbor as myself. You know, the golden rule, and so that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to practice the part of the Bible that I know that I have to do, and mm-hmm. that is that, and that's a full-time job.
It is indeed a full-time job. Well, your story, Elaine, is so compelling. That's why I began by saying I really want everybody to read Sarah's profile of you in the American Prospect. We're going to link to the online version from stateofbelief.com. Our time today is so limited that I really want to focus on the wisdom and insight that you can offer regarding what we see coming out of the Texas GOP today. In other words, the complete conflation of religious right language and party politics. How do you diagnose where figures like Ted Cruz and Rick Perry come from? Do you feel like you know the script they're reading from?
Well, I'm afraid I do. I'm afraid it used to be my script. And I really believe that I have moved to a different place.
And what about that script bothered you?
I don't believe that a theocratic, top-down, political position is what even Jesus would have embraced.
Mm-hmm. So the word is an interesting word. I always think of dominionist theology, dominionist practices when I see some of the things going on. Out of your own experience, is the dominionist posture with Perry and Cruz and these people, does that represent a true religious conviction, or is some part of that political strategy?
I think it just all blends together.
Mm-hmm.
There is the sense of people who are serious about their faith and serious about being involved in the civic conversation, and they may have read the Dominionist works, and they're out there trying to be responsible for their faith because they think God requires it.
Hmm. Before we get off the air, I want you to think about and say what you think every person listening to this show needs to know about the danger of so merging religion and politics that a person judges your religion by your political votes.
I think that Constantine started this whole thing with nationalizing Christianity,
uh-huh.
and I think that that's dangerous, and I don't think Jesus would be a part of it. I mean, I follow Jesus, and he basically stuck his fingers in all kinds of religious traditions and political traditions, and that's pretty much what got him executed. If I am going to be a person of faith who follows the Christian tradition that I do, then I'm going to have to look at all these issues and not be carried away by the religious right trends. And I'm just going to have to live the way I should.
Joyce Elaine White is a former leader within the Texas Christian Coalition. She spent much of her life in the service of fundamentalist religion and came to see that the conflation of faith and politics that it was her job to promote was not the force for good, so many were saying, and continue to say it is. A moving profile of Elaine White appears in the current issue of the American Prospect magazine. The author is journalist Sarah Posner, a frequent guest on this show, a good friend of mine. We'll link to that article from stateofbelief.com. Elaine, I want you to know you've helped a lot of people today, and thank you so much, Elaine.
All right.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show, friends. Without the financial support of State of Belief listeners, this show wouldn't be possible. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Visit us at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. The kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that we strive to present every week is virtually impossible to find anywhere else. So I hope you will consider helping us to keep this show on the air and to keep it well-funded so we do our job well. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcast. Stay in touch with us. You can do it throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. We also have a listener line you can call anytime, 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, that State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.